Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me, as always, is my friend and colleague, Jen Kalt of Humboldt Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hey, Tom.
All right. We are joined by two very special guests today, Darren Ward, Associate Professor of Fisheries Biology at Humboldt State University. Hey, Darren.
Hi, Tom.
And Jacob Pounds, Environmental Specialist with the Blue Lake Rancheria Environmental Department. Hey, Jacob.
Hi, y'all.
All right, so we're going to be talking about some disappointing news, which is that the invasive New Zealand mud snail was recently discovered in the Mad River. And so our guests today are going to help unpack what this might mean for the Mad River, for aquatic ecosystems here on the North Coast, and what we can do to try to stop the spread, because I assume we're going to want to stop the spread of this invasive new critter in our waters. To start off, Darren, you have published on the New Zealand mud snail before, so I can count you as an expert on this creature. What the heck is a New Zealand mud snail?
I should give you a caveat at first. I have published on them, but I don't consider myself a specialist. I'm a salmon specialist, and these things are a side project for me because they're so interesting. So, I mean, you asked what a mud snail is. They're a small snail. Like you guessed from their name, they're from New Zealand, and they were introduced to the United States back in the 80s. Sometimes it's not exactly clear how they got here, but since they've been introduced, they've been spreading around the country. They're just incredibly prolific little critters.
What does one look like? If I was to go out and look for a mud snail, would they be terribly apparent? Are we talking about big old honkers, or are they itty-witty-bitty things?
They're pretty small snails. A large adult would be less than a centimeter long. And they don't look that different from a lot of our native aquatic snails. They're small, sort of dark brownish or black colored, with a cone-shaped spiral shell, which is similar to a lot of our native snails. The things that are distinct about them that make them, that you could use to recognize them if you wanted to tell them apart from native snails. One way that people tell snails apart is the direction that the coils on their shell go. And mud snails have a shell that coils to the right, which if you hold the shell with the pointy end pointing up and away from you and turn it until the opening is facing you, that means that the opening will be on the right side. So that's not unique. There are other snails that have that, but that's one thing that you can use to identify them.
I presume it's because they're from the Southern Hemisphere, right? And yeah, don't toilets flush the other way? There was a whole Simpsons episode on this.
Yeah, if you flush a New Zealand mud snail, they'll spiral the other way. The other unique things about them are characteristics that you can use and identify them. They have a trap door over the opening of their shell that they can open and close. There's some native snails that have that too, but not all of them have that. Mud snails do. They often have a little ridge down the sort of the midline of the coil of their shells. If you look really closely, it's made up of tiny spines. Not all the individual mud snails will have that, but a lot of them do. And then the real characteristic that you can use that's kind of morbid, but if you really want to be sure that a small, dark-colored, cone-shaped snail that you found is a mud snail, the thing to do is to take it and crush it, because New Zealand mud snails are almost always pregnant, and they're almost all female. So if you take one and crush it and find lots of babies inside the body, inside the shell, then that's a sure sign that you found a New Zealand mud snail.
Oh, right, because they're live bearers. They don't lay eggs like a lot of other critters. Snails usually lay eggs, right?
Most snails, yeah, are egg layers. But New Zealand mud snails, they carry their eggs until they're hatched, and then they release live babies.
Gosh, are they similar enough to anything else that's local that, you know, if I go crushing them, I'm not going to be killing an endangered local snail, am I?
I wouldn't say that, actually. There is a native snail that looks very similar. That's a cone-shaped, dark-colored aquatic snail. I don't even know that they have a common name. Their genus name is Juga. A lot of people just refer to them as Juga snails. They get much bigger than mud snails. They'll get to be a couple centimeters long. But as juveniles, you know, the juvenile Juga snails will be the same size as a mud snail, and they look very similar. They have a trapdoor. They have the same shape of shell, same color. So it can be tough to tell them apart. If you count the whorls, they'll have fewer whorls than a mud snail in their shell.
So, Darren, can you talk a little bit about why should people care? I mean, I know from the plant world that a lot of times it's hard to get people to care about plants, especially if they're really small. Why should people care about New Zealand mud snails coming here in the Mad River?
I often say that if I was going to design something to be like the perfect, really prolific non-native species that just has, it's sort of just primed to establish populations and sort of explode to really high abundance. It would be a New Zealand mud snail. They can reproduce without a mate. So I mentioned that most of the population here is female. Their males are very rare, but they don't need males. They can reproduce without a mate. So it only takes one female New Zealand mud snail that's showing up at a new location, and that one could start a population all on her own. They don't have to mate. They're parthenogenic. And they can reproduce really rapidly. So the females are essentially born pregnant with embryos developing. And if conditions are right, if temperatures are right and there's lots of food, a newborn female only takes a month or 6 weeks to get to a size where it can start producing offspring. And they can make these broods of, you know, 10 to 50 offspring at a time, or even more than that, or if conditions are really good. And then each one of those offspring, you know, they can grow up and start producing offspring in a relatively short order. So the populations can just explode really rapidly from a single individual just to really, really high densities. There's situations where it's been documented that mud snails reach densities that are almost unheard of for aquatic invertebrates. I mean, up to like 500,000 per meter squared, just absolutely very, very high abundance. They can do that in a short time because of their fast reproduction. So when they reach those high abundances, they're taking up space. They're eating all the resources. There's not much left over for native invertebrates. So they become the dominant herbivore in those ecosystems when they do that. So, I mean, that's reason enough in itself to be concerned. A lot of people aren't concerned enough about other aquatic invertebrates that they'd care too much if they get excluded by New Zealand mud snails. A lot of people care about fish, and New Zealand mud snails themselves are not good food for fish, and they exclude the native invertebrates that are good food for fish. So I think that's what a lot of people are actually concerned about, is when these mud snails show up, that things will get worse for salmon and trout and, you know, all these endangered and threatened species that get a lot of attention locally are not going to be benefited by New Zealand mud snails showing up.
So, Jacob, how were these discovered in the Mad River? Were these something that people were out looking for, that we've had them in other areas of Humboldt County, so are now monitoring the Mad? Or was this a chance encounter? What's the story of their discovery?
Well, 2 years ago, Darren and I both had an occurrence in different places on the Mad River where there were a small number of New Zealand mud snails spotted. I think Darren saw his first at Pump One. And then while I was pulling my temperature loggers, which are 3 to 4 inch instruments that are inside of a PVC housing sitting on the bottom of the river for the low flow season, it ended up with about a dozen mud snails in there down at the county boat ramp. And so at that point, I was concerned that there was an infestation. It was really low density, and so it wasn't as much a concern at that time. Just make sure that that's noted and get it reported to the authorities, and then just kind of sit back and wait and see what happens. Well, 2 years later, we wait and saw what happened.
So we're now infested. When you say infestation, I think of when I had lice as a kid, and that was really terrible. So infestation is an important word to me. So the Mad River is inundated with these.
Well, yeah, and literally, and just a couple of days after we spotted these, the new location, I guess, where we've spotted these snails and they're in high densities is kind of near the confluence of where Lindsay Creek meets the Mad River.
Now, where's that?
If you go to Pump 4 and hike upstream about a quarter mile.
Okay.
It's right in that area. And yeah, the densities there, it just looks like there's giant, you know, 4 or 5 millimeter pepper flakes on the entire substrate of the river and all the algae and stuff. So it's extremely noticeable. And yeah, when I just a couple days later, pulled the instrument down at the boat ramp and noticed that the concrete surface of the boat ramp was again covered in mud snails and reported that to Fish and Wildlife. So there's at least two known spots with high densities at this point in the Mad. It's all in the lower river. And so controlling the way that people clean and disinfect and dry their items that come into contact with the river, whether that's a kayak or waders or boots or, you know, et cetera, is extremely important for controlling the spread of these snails.
So they're all the way down in the estuary now.
Yes.
So Lindsay Creek is the confluence is near the turnoff from 299 to Fieldbrook, more or less. So they're in the estuary back in 2015, they were discovered in College Creek on HSU campus. And Darren came on the show back then to talk about them. And my first thought was, oh no, Humboldt Bay is going to be inundated with these critters. And then that's when I learned, well, they can't really survive in salt water, but the county boat ramp is in the tidally influenced reach of the river, is it not?
It is, yes.
They live in brackish water.
Yeah, we did some sampling, some water quality sampling in there in like 2014 in a low flow period, both high tide and low tide in November. And we were seeing, I'd have to go back and look at the data sheets, but I think we were seeing concentrations as high as 26 parts per trillion salt water.
Parts per thousand to 26. That's a little bit less than seawater. That's pretty salty. That's something that's been surprising to me about mud snails as I learn more about them. They're freshwater organisms, but they can withstand a tidal cycle where they get immersed in full seawater as long as it's not permanent. So if they, you know, on a high king tide or something like that, if they're in full seawater for a couple hours, that's no problem. They'll just close that little trap door on their shell and ride it out. Even sites that are permanently brackish, up to maybe like a third or even half the concentration of seawater, is okay for them. They'll actually do fine as long as it's not more concentrated than that. They can handle that permanently. So I don't think Humboldt Bay is at risk because it's full strength seawater almost all the time, except for big winter storms. But certainly the estuaries, the mouths of the stream around Humboldt Bay, actually seem like great habitat for mud snails. They're sort of, I think, all at risk of having invasions.
So within the Mad River, they seem like they're kind of located in areas where there is a lot of human traffic currently, right? The boat ramp. And do we anticipate that they are going to go upriver by themselves? How do we think that they are moving within the Mad River, establishing in new areas?
Well, Darren just posted a great video that he took of the mud snails moving in the river, and it was sped up. It was really cool. You should check it out on YouTube.
All right. Go to the show notes on lascosoutpost.com. We'll have the video linked there.
I watched it, and I was like, oh, my gosh, they're really fast. And then I realized, oh, this is a
Yeah, that's accelerated, but it is impressive. I think I just was curious and put a GoPro camera down on one of those high density mud snail patches just to see how much they're moving around. And I let it record for a half hour or so. And then I watched it, and, you know, watch it at regular speed, it doesn't look like much, but if you watch it sped up, it's clear that these things are moving constantly and actually predominantly upstream. They're sort of, it looks like a sort of constant conveyor belt of them working their way upstream. So I think there is potential for them to move around on their own, but they're really easy to transport accidentally by people. I mean, if you wade around in a location with mud snails and then look at your shoes afterwards or wading boots or whatever you're wearing, you'll almost certainly see mud snails all over them. And, you know, all it would take is fishing in that location at the upper pump station and then going up to the hatchery and fishing there. And we would have mud snails up there. That's as easy as it is to move them around. In fact, you could fish at the pump station one day and then fish at the hatchery 3 days later and still move mud snails if you don't do a good job of cleaning your gear. They don't have to be in the water all the time. As long as it's damp, they're okay. In order to kill them by drying them out, it has to be really, really dry. So a pair of shoes or boots or something like that that's just sitting around for a couple of days and doesn't get completely bone dry, the mud snails on there are still going to be alive. They're really easy to accidentally move around. And the juveniles are so small that you wouldn't even see them. So just you looking at your gear and not seeing any mud snails doesn't mean that it's clean enough that you wouldn't be moving them. It's going to take people really paying a lot of attention to disinfecting to prevent them from moving around.
Welcome to the Eco News Report. Joining us are Jacob Pounds, environmental specialist with the Blue Lake Rancheria, and Darren Ward, associate professor of fisheries biology at Humboldt State University. And we're talking about New Zealand mud snails and their discovery in the Mad River. Yeah, let's talk about best practices for fishermen, for other river users to avoid moving these into new areas. It sounds like you have to let things get bone dry. Is there anything else that folks can do to ensure that they're not accidentally transporting these little buggers?
I mean, really best case is you have one dedicated pair of boots and waders, if that's what you're doing fishing, or shoes or whatever, dedicated to the watershed that you're in, so you don't cross-contaminate other watersheds. That's kind of a simple thing to do, although it's, you know, that's expensive and getting multiples of things and it takes up lots of space. That's kind of a big deal. I guess freezing, if you have the ability to completely freeze your gear for more than 4 hours and then let it completely dry for 48 hours, that's a good disinfectant technique. And there's other, like I use a chemical bath, a chemical salt called Vercon, which in a 2% concentration requires a 30-minute soak in order to kill New Zealand mud snails and all sorts of other invasive algaes and diseases and things. But that's because, you know, I'm usually moving spots on the river and I need to be able to disinfect in between the spots. So those are some common methods of doing it.
I think one thing that's important to point out is that soak time that you mentioned, the 30 minutes. There are lots of guidelines that you read on the internet where people will use kind of home remedies. People use Formula 409, that disinfectant that you can buy for your house, and other cleaners that have similar ingredients. And those things will kill mud snails, but it's not like you spray it on your gear and then you're disinfected. If you're going to do something like that, the disinfectant has to be in contact with the mud snails for often a really long time, you know, a half an hour or more to actually kill them. So I think there's no way to get around the fact that if we're going to contain these things, it's sort of going to put a damper on people's ability to just jump around on the Mad River and go from site to site, because just doing that is easily going to move them around.
So if they're in the Mad River now and they're moving themselves, you know, and they're such a tricky thing to get off of your clothing and to make sure that you're totally disinfected, is it hopeless that we can stop them in the Mad River?
I was impressed how long we went before they got into the Mad River.
There's always a silver lining.
The news has got out a couple of times. I mean, we had the talk before on the show when they showed up on campus. And I think there was a period where, at least from the research side, I mean, I guess I don't know so much about people who are just out recreationally, but people got really careful about disinfecting when they were discovered on campus. And I think the same thing happened. You know, they're in the lagoons up in the state park, and they're in the Klamath River, and they're in the Smith. And every time this hits the news, there's a period where people are really careful and it slows them down. And then I think what happens is people forget about it or get lazy because it's been a long time, and then they get transported to a new spot. So I think there is good potential to at least slow them down really dramatically if people sort of stay vigilant, but that's what it takes.
And so they're in the Smith, they're in the Klamath, they're in the lagoons. Is there somewhere that these mud snails are not at this point? Major rivers or major areas where people go fishing?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because I say they're in the Klamath and they're in the Smith, they're in Redwood Creek, they're in all these places, but a lot of the other rivers where they show up, they're there, but they're very patchy. The lagoon at the mouth of Redwood Creek has a lot of mud snails, but you go upstream a quarter mile and you can't find one. The lagoons are the same way. Where Maple Creek empties into Big Lagoon, there's a ton of mud snails. And in Big Lagoon, there's a ton of mud snails. But you go a quarter mile up Maple Creek and you can't find them. And there's patches like that on the Smith. There's patches on the Klamath too, although we've recently discovered that Bogus Creek up by Iron Gate Hatchery has mud snails. So it looks like there may be a new patch up there. So it's not like these whole river systems are infested with them. There are lots of places where you can go on those rivers and not see any mud snails. We'll see what happens on the Mad. Hopefully it turns out to be the same way, that we have sort of these isolated patches where conditions seem to be good for mud snails and they don't sort of spread and take over the whole system. It's too soon to know, though, I think, if that's going to be the case. The way they increased over the past 2 years since we first found them is that seems different than the other streams where I've been talking about them, where they're very patchy. So we may be in a different situation in the Mad River where they'll explode to a larger distribution and a higher abundance, but I think it's too soon to really know.
Based on the way they spread, if I had to guess, I would guess that they would spread like Port Orford cedar root disease, where there are roads, lots of roads crossing streams and rivers. That's where they're going to be infections, because that's where our infestations, rather, because that's where people are going to fish, because it's easy to get there in a car.
Right. And so the other spots that I've been in the river, in the Mad River specifically this year, and I haven't seen them, are up near Blue Lake. I haven't seen any signs of them up near that swimming hole at the Mad River there. I haven't seen them near the mouths of Maple and Boulder Creek, which is another place that I've been to. And I'll be out in a couple other places like the mouth of Kenyon Creek and then upriver below the tailwater of Matthews Dam here in the next week. Now that I'm looking for them, I'm just kind of doing that in addition to pulling all my seasonal temperature loggers.
So there are a lot of fishermen who listen to this show and our fisher people up here on the North Coast are some great conservationists, and they want to help out as much as they can. And I'm sure that they would like to help out in looking for these snails. If someone comes across a patch of mud snails, what should they do with that information?
What I've had success with is I have a couple contacts with California Fish and Wildlife, Michelle Gilroy and
Breck Alexander.
There we go. I couldn't think of his last name. Thanks, Darren. So Breck is the aquatic invasive species specialist for the state, and he's based out of Redding. He's the one that actually takes documentation of the infestations and makes it like an official part of Fish and Wildlife's database. Michelle is a local contact that works in the office that I've worked with her on other projects like the summer steelhead dives. And so I have her contact information from that.
And is there kind of a best protocol for someone if they want to try to document an area? I imagine you probably want some sort of photographic evidence, and it's not just, oh yeah, I saw a bunch here.
Yeah. The fact that there's native snails that look really similar to them, it's important if you think you find them to get a really good photograph, like as macro lens or something like that, as zoomed in as you possibly can so that someone can get a positive identification.
Maybe include something for scale, a dime or something else so that you can get a relative size of these things.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think the first time at the boat ramp, I had a pair of pliers. And so just seeing it in relation to the jaws of the pliers was helpful.
So is there any hope that our waters can adapt, right? We have this invasive species. It seems like it's not going to go away and that we don't have any sort of cures for once it's in here. Is that just a fool's? Am I foolish to hope that, you know, eventually our ecosystems will learn to live with these things?
No, I don't think that's actually foolish. It's interesting that how I described their sort of patchy distribution that they seem to have in local rivers, that's pretty typical. So their mud snails are famous for becoming very abundant at popular fishing spots, probably because fishermen move them around. And so there's all these world-class fishing destinations that have New Zealand mud snail infestations. And so because they're popular spots, they've been the focus of a lot of research. The effects of the mud snails have been really dramatic at sort of the base of a food chain on the algae and other resources and on the other invertebrates that they're maybe competing with. But it's been harder to demonstrate that they really have a severe effect on fish populations. And it's probably because of those patchy abundances. You know, fish are large and mobile enough that if there's a big patch where there's mud snails that aren't good food, they can avoid that patch. And it doesn't necessarily have a large effect on their survival and growth in the long term. So I think that's a reason for some hope. If we have systems like that here where maybe we have locations that end up with really high densities of mud snails, but they're not so large that fish don't have an alternative that they can move to, then it might not actually be that detrimental to our endangered fish populations. But that's uncertain at this point. Like I said, we don't know what's going to happen on the Mad River. And just the risk that they become very abundant and widespread, I think, is enough that we should still be very careful.
Yeah, I agree with Darren. And also one interesting fact about last year's water year was that we didn't get that much bedload turnover. And so I'll be curious to see if, you know, we get some better water years where there's extended higher flows in the river and then see if that keeps the distribution down in the lower river. I mean, obviously, if they get established further up, that could be problematic for that. That's just something I'm curious about.
All right. Well, when there's more information about mud snails, we'll have you both on for an update. So again, everybody who's listening, if you're going to go play around in the Mad River, be sure to completely, completely dry out your stuff or soak it in some sort of an approved disinfectant. You know, read the labels, use it as directed. Don't just spray and hope everything is going to be okay.
Or freeze. I think freezing is good.
Yeah, freeze is a good one too. Put them in your chest freezer. You know, it's full of fish anyways. Throw in your waders. It'll feel at home. Darren or Jacob, last thoughts on mud snails.
I feel like there's one thing you can't do a presentation about mud snails without at least mentioning the fact that a lot of the mud snails that do end up getting eaten by fish just ride through the fish intact and come out the other side alive. There's so many amazing things about these guys. It's hard not to be impressed by them, despite the fact that they're sort of nefarious and potentially detrimental.
Invasive species are always so amazing to me. Like, how could this have existed in some other ecosystem and they had an effective check on this thing that it comes to America and then just takes off Japanese knotweed or mud snails. It's incredible.
Pampas grass is also parthenogenic. So pampas grass doesn't need a mate to reproduce. And it just seems particularly nefarious that these creatures have invaded natural habitats and are so successful, and then they don't even need a mate. They're just clones of themselves. I mean, it's like an alien invasion, or for literally, maybe evolution will leave them in the dust, though, someday.
They're the settler colonialists of the plant and aquatic.
Oh, God, I hope that they're better than us. It certainly doesn't seem to be as detrimental to salmon as Euro-Americans. All right. Well, with that, we can end today's Eco News Report. Darren, Jacob, thank you so much for joining the Eco News Report. It's always good to have experts like yourselves, even if you don't think of yourself as an expert, Darren, on the show. You are helping us all learn about our own little slice of heaven a little bit more. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks you guys so much for coming on the show.
All right.
Thanks y'all.
Bye.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. This has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Join us next week on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.